if a person, let's say, have a problem or have a conflict, could be at the level of the family, at the level of institution, could be a conflict in all means. Under this system was clear that basically what we call society was a set of norms. Why in a society who think that the world is organized around the idea of nature, nature understood as a sort of logic organization self-contained, why that people would think that a set of norms is the best definition of society? It's because, again, what happened is that as more close with nature we go, better we are. For example, biology. What we need to do as a human being is try to copy and reproduce what the animals do. If you have a look, all the studies, an example which is called biology nowadays, and this way it was called zoology, people was observing the animals to see what relation was on human beings. But the idea was that as more close we went to nature, for example, observing animals, more close we are to understand how human beings behave. Why? Because at the end we are animals. So if we have any chance to understand how society works, that chance will be getting close to nature and discovering the law of nature. Okay? So that is when sociology, at the end of the century, came up as a self-contained discipline, which purpose and target and aim is to study this set of norms. Why it was important? Because after the Industrial Revolution, this single poor individual started to suffer, and all sorts of problems start to happen. Not only in terms of collective way, they say revolutions, depression, and so on, but individually speaking, people start to have conflicts. Basically, not only because of the Industrial Revolution, but because of the consequence. Remember, we discussed this idea that God was dead. I mean, the fact that society was organized around the idea that some superior entity justify our life. When that disappeared, let's say in the middle of 17th century or at the end of the 17th century, a great emptiness appeared, who in one way or the other was covered by, if you want, for the new idea of science and somehow by the work of the artist. But that was not enough. I mean, the damage, if you want, was done. So what happened is, when people start to think in this poor individual, let's call it in that way, they start to realize that should be a discipline who should take care about the problem who society itself has, but as well the problem that this individual has. And they call that science sociology. And the guy who basically are two guys who are considered, one is called Durkheim and the other is I got a hole. well, he's going to come. Don't worry. He said, well, two French guys. Why? Because the French society was probably at that time more evolved than the other society. Why I explain this to you? Because in the same way that people start to realize that we have these sociological issues, people start to realize that these problems might be not necessarily at the level of society as such, but maybe at the level of something who is non-visible, something who is an individual itself. And that is when psychiatry came on board, and especially one of the masters of who call it Charcot. Charcot is, if you want, probably the father of psychiatry. I mean, the people, the author who start to treat individuals as someone who have some kind of sickness, who is connected with the way in which the psyche has been evolved. either because it's connected with the individual history of a patient, either because it's connected with something will happen in society who really damage the individual. But the idea was, the problem was inside. The problem was invisible. And of course, I mean, at that time, Charcot in particular was a doctor. I mean, as you imagine, when a disciplina came up, there was no a career in university, call it psychiatry, where some doctors who were taking this avant-garde approach, and they call it in that way. I mean, the school of psychiatry came 20 or 30 years later. What I'm trying to say is that this was grounded in all the idea of cure, were coming from the traditional medicine. That is that you can treat physically the patient to cure the psychological problem. And that is the basic definition of psychiatry, if you want. In relation to what is going to happen, was one of his students, colleague Sigmund Freud. Because a big distinction between Freud and Charcot is exactly that. What Freud called psychoanalysis is a treatment to someone, but without, if you want, normally, without physical interference. That is, you treat the patient with a technique who do not suppose to have any physical intervention with the patient, either in the way of drugs or either in the way of Charcot and other people were doing. I mean, the techniques were very, very wild and savage. I mean, for example, one technique that was used in the Nietzsche as well was, this was a room with very, very big holes, and here were sort of tubes who were similar to the ones that the firemen use, with really, really, in which the water came out, really a high pressure, and they put the patient here. I mean, so you see, this was going, I promise you, that was true. That was shock treatment. They were convinced that this kind of, I mean, the water, of course, imagine, this was happening in a place which is called Salpêtrière, which was in Paris, a beautiful building. And Salpêtrière was the place in which Charcot was doing this. And they were really convinced that this was helping the people. I mean, so, because they see, you see, this is the big change, in if you want, in one way or the other. In this world, people was forced to believe that whatever you have in your inside, whatever is invisible, at some point, came up, physically speaking. So this is called somatization. The fact, an example that you are a nervous person, and so this is the typical joke from doctor and psychoanalyst, you know. In the films, they use the same trick. I mean, to denotate that someone is really nervous, what they do. You know, remember the James Bond, Mr. No, Dr. No, was whatever. So, you see, I mean, the idea was that does not matter how long it takes, in a particular moment, there is something physical on you that prove and denotate that you, psychologically speaking, have a problem. That was the hypothesis. Why? Because they say, if human beings follow nature in one way or the other, therefore, if they are the same rules that we apply for nature, we can apply to the body of the human beings, that means that sooner or later, if something happens in nature, emerge. I mean, whatever, in the interior, remember that in the 19th century, geology, all those disciplines that now are well established, were coming up. I mean, the idea that, for example, a headquarter is a proof that the core of the earth is alive was one of these theories. So everything was connected. So the body of the person was something that is, if you want, we cannot see the interior, but if something is wrong in the interior, it's going to come up. So what these people was creating was a methodology to accelerate the moment in which these things came up. Because when these things came up, physically speaking, they treat that, or they were believing that they have a cure for that. So this shock treatment, the object, was exactly that. was the idea that we encourage the patient to develop more quickly the sickness. And it's funny, because if you see penicillin and all the drugs working this way, what the drugs do to you is accelerate your sickness to figure out a better treatment more quickly. That's the reason why when you take a very, very strong drug, you are, you know, almost dying. But what happened is, when this war disappeared, therefore, when people start to question the fact that nature was a self-organizing contained system, and when people start to question that the best way to do art was doing representation of the world, we have a problem. Why? Because this assumption that at some point the physical aspect are going to come up did not happen. And this was the first hypothesis of Freud, and was exactly the idea of hysteria. Because Freud says there are too many, if you want, sickness. Maybe in some cases, yes, there isn't a physical manifestation, but the most important sickness of individuals are coming from the fact that they are living in a particular environment, say in industrial society, if you want to put it in our terms nowadays. So if that is true, in one way or the other, we are sick, but there are people who are more sick than others. So what Freud was saying, basically was saying that we can be sick all our life without noticing that, because we don't have the certainty that this sort of nature in you is going to come up. And the most extreme hypothesis was that was extreme, not necessarily in Freud, but in people who was following Freud during the 20th century, is that saying that the society is sick, but they don't know about it. A lot of people make joke about that. But the important thing is that Freud was trying to develop a tool to try to explore this unknown area who not necessarily is going to be visible, physically speaking. So how this happened? How was the name of this guy? Durkheim?
Wasn't von
Krause. No. Was another guy who called it Le Bon. Le Bon was the theory of the crowd, and he was good. But no, this is one classic in sociology. For God's sake, I read the complete work of this man. It was a nightmare. I made two exams about this guy. I hate the guy. I was having a nightmare when I was a student about this guy. He created, in one way or the other, the methodology of social science, because he developed a new idea of experience in social science. Basically, what Galilei represent to science, the fact that he says we need to have a theory and empirical data, that approach was made by this guy applicable to social science, saying we have the experience, we need to profit from the experience, and then we need to have some kind of theory. It's going to go over. So let's try to make a graphic of Freud here. So you have the consciousness, and you have the unconsciousness as the two sides of the human, not necessarily brain, but the human psyche. So what we do every day life, normal is consciousness, people have control over that, or at least they believe, so with that is no problem. What Freud was trying to explore was this part, who he says in In one book, say it's the as the dark side of the moon. We know it's there, but we cannot see it, and even more, we don't know what the hell is there. And this is connected with the kind of change that I mentioned to you. This idea that what became more important for thinking and for create art is not visible anymore in nature. So it's this idea that civilization has more sophisticated became, more clear is that what is important for people is invisible. The values became invisible. Remember, we discussed that already. So in that context, is normal, or is we can expect that someone like a Freud is going to come up with a theory saying that the more important part of the psyche, who, as you know, the psyche, the concept, as a concept, the psyche has been a long, have a long history within philosophy, art, and so on. Even the Greeks were discussing what was the meaning of the psyche. So, to understand the human being, seems that the one important part is to understand how the psyche works and functions. In that sense, Freud joined a philosophical classic tradition. What is different on him is that he says that it's completely non-accessible to normal treatment. Let's say people cannot talk about that because they are obviously they don't have access to that, but even doctors and medicine, even using drugs, who was not a theory, by the way. Because you see, what was interesting is that the psychiatry was having this idea that if a man became unconsciousness, they were believing that they could access to the unconsciousness of the human being. And for that reason they were using drugs as well. Even Freud, as a student, was himself experimenting with different kind of drugs, hallucinogens. Why? Because they were thinking that if you remain awake, but you are an unconsciousness, people can talk to you, and using different techniques, they can have access to all this data and information that normally in the ordinary day life they don't. Well, Freud says, after the experience they do, they did, they say that's not true. I mean, we can try with drugs, maybe in some special cases it's true that we can have access to some kind of information, but as a regular methodological system that is not true. So that's when he created psychoanalysis, which is this sort of exchange between the patient and the doctor, in which they construct using different techniques this sort of narration about the patient. And this is a sort of approach. I mean, never Freud said, as some people misunderstood, that he is going to tell you how what are the characteristics of your unconsciousness. What Freud was proposing was a sort of technique who can give you a hint about particular problems, so you can give it a sort of light approach. In that sense, Freud created this new idea of invisible treatment, if you want, in one way or the other. You see, normally, doctors in the 19th century, from where Freud's environment was, he was coming from that environment, were saying that when you are going to see a doctor, the doctor make a semiosis of you. Means they watch your body, they touch your body, and after that, they produce the diagnosis. All right. So what Freud was saying, he says, I don't need to do that. For the first time, he was doing a treatment with a patient without touching the patient and without, in one way or the other, seeing the body of the patient. And that is a famous thing that you know the chair. You know, go there, you know. And the doctor sitting down here, that's a stereotype, but basically have a part of truth, which was allow the patient to be relaxed, but without interfering physical speed. The first patient Freud was having in Austria were a woman who in one way or the other were unhappy, were unsatisfied, and were having different kind of problems. So he was experimenting that. That was 1898, 1905, 1903, that period. So, I'm considering how we can have some kind of access to that. Well, Freud created a sort of trilogy. So Freud said there are three moments in which we can, in some ways, have some kind of access to this unconsciousness. Why? Because there are moments in which we do not have the control of the consciousness. Those three moments are the dreams, whatever they are, nightmares or not, the jokes you make, and what is called lapsus linguae, meaning, an example, imagine you have a girlfriend is called Jane, but you have a lover as well who is called Teresa. So you picking up the phone and say to Jane, "Hello, Teresa." You see, that is called lapsus linguae. So Freud says that if you explore this area regularly in a period of time on a particular person, you can have really a picture of and identify basically what is the problem, what kind of psychological, I mean, if it's a sort of neurosis or if it's in a sort of schizophrenia and so on. And secondly, following these, you can identify what are the obsessions, the weakest points and so on, and establish a treatment. And this is an interesting thing, the treatment was not to treat physically again the patient, but to make the patient conscious of these things. So you see, let's go back to the beginning. You have the man, you have the world, or say nature. In the old system that we were talking, what was important was the relation between the world and the man. So according to the psychiatry treatment, when the man was having problem is because something here was broken. So what was the function of the psychiatric? Was establish the link again. Okay? Was a problem of non-adaptation to the society. That was the idea of psychiatry. More interesting than Freud, and say, no, in the cases he was experiencing, say, this kind of non-connection with nature, Freud says, is normal. It should be that way. Why? Because society is not doing very well. Of course the individual is not doing very well, but society is not doing very well. Why? Because Freud disbelieved that society was self-organized. And he disbelieved that looking into society deeply, 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 you are right to nature and you have any sense there. He was refusing to avoid, to accept that, as many people were refusing at that time. So, what we do? Well, the only possibility is to avoid this and to try to make the man consciousness of this inevitable, Freud says that, inevitably broken link. Freud explained this in the idea of, if you want, Oedipo or Electra, if you want. Because when Freud was trying to explain how the idea of nature was not working anymore as in the classical view, what he did was to explain the man through his growing period, basically. Go back to the family. Who was the father? How was the father? Who was the mother? How was the mother? So, what the people like Charcot and other people was doing with nature, Freud was doing with the family. And that's why there is always this stereotype saying that if you have a sort of paranoid situation, is because you were an unhappy child or things like that. This joke had to do with the fact, which is exactly true, that Freud was saying whatever problem you have as an adult is connected with the period in which you were growing up. So whatever damage, broken link, connection between you and society, Freud always explained that at the level of the family. The unit was the family. However, the last stage is this one, is the moment in which the treatment was make the patient self-conscious of the problem, not figure out a solution of the problem. Never Freud says so. But yes, make him conscious and say, okay, this is the problem, how we deal. And the idea is that this was a regular treatment. Remember, because what happened with the people like a Charcot was, they say, you have a problem, we identify the problem, we found the solution, we move on. That's it, end of the question. What Freud was talking about, especially the late Freud, the Freud who started to write about culture, was saying these problems are not problems connected with individual, they are problems connected with the civilization we are living with. So our long and terminal sickness is not something who is going to come up, you're going to figure a solution. No. You grow up with that and you will be dying with this. He called it the sickness of the civilization. This idea that we are unhappy sometimes and we don't know why. We are depressed sometimes and we don't have very clear reason why. Freud says this is a civilization issue. It's not an individual thing. So basically, the consequence is that the treatment, the psychoanalytic treatment, is going to be there forever, regularly. Yeah. So whatever happened in the 20th century later, whatever application of this theory could be done for politics, culture, art, this is the base and this is the idea. I mean, then of course you have the book of Freud, the classic, is the Interpretation of Dreams, in which he basically wrote the whole theory about not only dream but about the psychoanalysis. But certainly Freud wrote another book later, up to the last one, which is the book about the civilization, which is he wrote 1 year before he died in the 30s. But what I'm saying to you is, doesn't matter how many features you can add to these two position to these two schools, at the end what counts is that the one counts for a particular context, which was a classic one, connected with nature, with a particular idea of science, with a particular idea of representation in art. And the other world count for something who is not visible anymore, for problems who cannot be treated physically speaking anymore. And especially what was interesting to see was that not many years after Freud gets a certain kind of reputation, what happened in Europe was the First World War, who was really a test for this kind of problem. I mean, people who was coming from the war, remember, if you have present what happened in the First World War, was that was called the war of the whore, because they were having, remember, those lines in which they were having this whore, and they spent months and months, the soldiers, in the middle of the whore, one facing the other, for the Maginot, we're calling it French, La Ligne Maginot. And so what happened is that people was getting crazy because they spend there without possibility of moving, because if you move out, someone kill you from there. So it was a nightmare. They spent months and months. So quite a lot of soldiers who came back from the war came back with really psychoanalytical problems, let's call it that way. So that was the moment in which as well some governments and some public institutions start to pay attention to what Freud did, and that was the moment in which the psychoanalysis, if you want, became institutionalized, because they realized that could be a very political and interesting tool. So basically, if you want, let's try to do this in a political term. This is not quite right, but this is the best way to explain it. Who came after Freud? Well, you have two people. The people who we can call out at the left the Freud, and the people who are to the right of the Freud. So, here were a group of people who they were saying, okay, we acknowledge that Freud, in one way or the other, discovered an area who was completely uncharted, but however, need to be complemented anyway with a medical treatment, as the classics were doing. So this group of people were saying, we've taken up from Freud some stuff, but some theory, basic ones, need to came down from the psychiatry. And they say as well from some other disciplines, like archaeology, and then we'll say later they will say biology. So this school, for example, was a school of, then there are many, Otto Rank, an example, Adel. Reich. So were people that they are different between them, of course. I mean, the common element is that they were, we can say, allocated on the right of the floor. Why? Because they were accepting some theory from they were questioning the other, and basically the basic questioning was regarding to non-considering. The fact that Freud was refusing to consider any traditional medical approach. On the left, probably the most notorious one, we can say that, is Lacan. And what the people on the left do, basically, is to put to the extreme the theory of Freud. As you imagine, in this scheme, you see dreams, joke, lapsus of lingua. I mean, the linguistic element is there. I mean, basically, language was a more important tool to Freud theory. That was evident. But even Freud was not convinced by that, so he didn't make an essay talking about the language itself and how important it was in relation with psychoanalysis. The person who did that was Lacan. Because Lacan put to the extreme the Freud theory and said, our unconsciousness is an aberration, is a piece of an aberration, it's a language thing. What we need to do is to create something who will allow us to access to that aberration. And that's imagined, as you can see, from that perspective, why Lacan was so successful in humanities and social science, because he's saying basically that what we need to figure out is a narration. So if we have a linguistic background and we know how language works, we know, well, we are going to know how the unconsciousness works. Of course, as you can imagine, when they took off, never they came back to talk again, basically. Probably Freud was the last one to be the person who was convening for one or the other, because
Lacan was working with Freud as well, Adler himself. What is important is the institutionalization. Those two schools were completely different. As you can imagine, this one, because the medical element were more connected with the idea of health, connected with the state. And this one was more connected with the idea that psychoanalysis is a sort of avant-garde discipline and need to remain in the private without any connection with the state. And that is one of the reasons why Lacan was so criticized, because he as well establish this idea that let's put it in this way, to have a decent treatment you need to suffer the treatment, and that need to be done on two levels: one, psychologically speaking, and two, monetary speaking. So you need to pay. That's the idea. He made a hell of a lot of money. because if not, you don't take it that seriously. That's the idea, basically. Of course, there was a lot of polemic about this, and people were discussing. Even Lacan came up in TV at some point, I think it was in the 70s, discussing the issue. I mean, now it's not that hot argument, because as you know, psychoanalysis as it is after Lacan died has been explored in so many different schools and theories and so on, and basically the countries who were more strong in psychoanalysis were France and Argentina, together with the States, but the States not that much, excluding two or three cities. And now that is almost, well, not disappearing, but came down the figures something as a minority. And on the contrary, the people who were working in the area of psychiatry, they have been really, really, if you want, taking over from the psychoanalysis. Why? Well, because drug companies are very powerful, because the development of the drug, different drugs, are really, really, really strong. So, because the treatment now, the collateral damage are much less than what happened in the 19th century. So now you can have a shock treatment in a very, very precise environment. I mean, in a particular organ or whatever. And that do not affect you as a person. So in that sense, imagine is very popular, because people prefer that treatment in which you have this idea that you have a kind of solution, even if it's an illusionary one, but the ordinary life, that day life, is important. And the other alternative, which is what, keep going to see a psychoanalyst person? Well, that's not, it's not going very well with what the people do nowadays. I mean, people as well work quite a lot, so they don't have that much time. So how this fit, if you want, in a particular theory, let's say, in a theory of the culture, or a theory, or a literary theory. Well, basically, as you can imagine from this perspective, from the fact that what is your first statement as a human being, according to Freud, is that you have a broken link with your family. Imagine you are going to be unhappy your whole life. So that's basically Freud. He didn't say so in that way, but implicitly is that. Implicitly is that what happened to you when you were a child, who damaged you one way or the other, is what became the object of your adult life. So you tried all your adult life to recover what you lost in your childhood. That is Freud's perspective. And indeed, if you imagine, if you transfer that from the individual into the culture, well, what the culture is going to be? What is going to be the function of the culture? A consolation. The culture is going to be a tool created by human beings to consolate themselves because this is lost. So, if the consolation is good, art is going to be good. If it's not, well, you are going to be unhappy. You see, this is important. Why? Because the idea of value connected with art disappeared. Art became a functional piece.
a functional object. It's not connected necessarily with aesthetics. However, it is true that Freud as well developed a theory in which he was saying that a sort of, let's say, no consolation, but a sort of relaxed moment came when human beings perceive something as aesthetical nice. So he was acknowledging that even though he had this negative perspective of culture, he acknowledged that there was some kind of non-clear reason, but exist, that people at some point regard a painting, for example, and get this kind of nice perception, nice sensation. So basically what Freud was saying is that there was an aesthetical dimension of the human being who cannot be explained, but is there. However, that is not enough to change what culture really is. So basically he was saying the aesthetical dimension of the human being is there, came up time to time, but is not regularly there. What is regular there is you, your childhood, your problem, if you want, the culture and the society. That is what is there. What happened in terms of literature is that, imagine this theory for a novelist is like a music, because imagine how many features of a character you can create following this. Because an example, I mean, if you think how many novels has been created in which to characterize a particular hero has a good or has a bad, they go back to the childhood and they start to talk about how he grew up. I mean, with flashback, without flashback, doesn't matter, but that is was quite unusual in the 19th century. Example, Madame Bovary. Remember Madame Bovary? You know the story of Madame Bovary, this sort of woman who get a lover and how it's spread. At no point in the novel was any explanation about the childhood of the woman to explain why she was unhappy or why she was having an affair or whatever. At no point. Why? Because that was coming from a writer for whom that kind of thinking was completely alien. He never would imagine that he need to go back to the childhood of the woman to explain this. But answer for a theory, this was a very, very common. And in films, well, I don't need to tell you, film is always like that. Especially when more savage is the character, even the more provocative films. You see, there are ways to go back. I mean, because it's not only the idea you need to go back to the childhood, it's the idea that to explain what you are doing now, you need to go back one or two days behind. That's it. Before Freud, that idea was completely madness. Why? Because if you want to have a big explanation, you go back to nature. If you want to have an immediate explanation, you go back to the day you were living. Period. This idea that to explain what you do today, logically, you need to go back to 2, 3 days, 1 year or two, that was completely unknown to the 19th century people. In the way that we do it immediately, because in my 19th century people, the people who was working on theories, the idea was, if we talk about the immediacy, we talk about it today. If we talk about something more general, we talk about monuments, archaeology, nature, a big picture. But now, we don't have any more that coherent agreement between the panorama and the local, because that's just exploited. So what happened now is that from the local, from what we are and what we do, we try to explain the panorama. You see? In that context is when Freud came up with the theory, because Freud says, look guys, I have a theory about the unconsciousness who can allow you to see the big picture, and you will be less happy. Not happy, but less happy. So, from that perspective, imagine for writers. I mean, that is fantastic. Because you can do whatever. I mean, you can create characters and go back and explain that something happened and start to mix all the relations. And this idea of the psychological profile who was almost unknown, because you see, I mean, what happened with the novel in the 19th century is that it was wrote, most of them, in the third person. as someone who was there, say, this is one character making talk to the character and so on. What happened with after the Freud and the impact on literature is that the person who was the narrator going into the story. You see, why that happened? Well, exactly because that was done by a person who seriously believed that the self-reflection about who he is or she is going to help to enlighten particular problems. And that was completely unthinkable in the 19th century, because the self-reflection on you, which was existing indeed in the 19th century, was grounded, if you want, in relations, or was grounded in your social connections, or, but not about you. I mean, the fact that you can explore your interior, your inside, your psyche, to enlighten a particular problem, that was completely unthinkable. And this is as well important from the sociological point of view. Why? Because if you go to an individual and say, you have the tools in your hands to change your life, what you are saying is that a stable system, grounded in really, really strong division of class, disappear, or not disappear, but became questioning. Why? Because if you have your own tools, you can do your own life. Why you are going to accept that you are poor? You can become rich, or worse, you can question the way in which the rich are ruling the society. And that as well explains why, at the beginning of the century, in this environment and context, if you want, happens two or three big revolutions, especially the one in Russia and the one in Mexico, who really were saying, look guys, your life is in your hands. I mean, if we are going to have an state, that state should, in one way or the other, be in a sort of delegation from that power that we have. So, from that point of view, as well, I think Freud theory, the psychoanalysis in general, became very, very interesting. And what as well is another element is the idea of, if you want, crisis, the idea of conflict, and the idea of incommensurability. These three ideas are recurrent at the beginning of the century, and these were ideas that one or the other, all the people who was connecting with psychoanalysis, either because they were applying psychoanalysis to a particular piece of work, or either because they were creating theory connected with psychoanalysis, they were dealing with that. They were saying the discipline who tackle, the discipline who approach, or the discipline which aim as is to deal with the problem of crisis, deal with the problem of conflict, and deal with the problem of incommensurability is the psychoanalysis. The psychoanalysis is a sort of dialect. Remember, we discussed it at the beginning of dialectic. Yeah. The idea that we don't have any more this one extreme and the other. What we have is this kind of gray area. This idea that what really counts is not the antithesis in or the thesis, is the synthesis basically, which is a sort of non in which no one is happy basically. And that's the idea of crisis. We are living in a context, sociologically speaking, culturally speaking, who is not clear. It's not black and white, it's grey. And people in that context is happy, and sometimes is lost. To figure out a way to help the people within that context, we have psychoanalysis. That was the theory after the First World War. And of course, this idea of incommensurability is connected with the idea that because we don't believe in nature anymore, what was happening in the world was too much. The notion of reality was too much to handle. That is basically all the conclusion that the people who were working with soldiers who came back from the war, basically they were facing this kind of problem. Reality was not necessarily too big, was too harsh, and people were just disconnected because they feel they cannot handle it. So That is as well connected with other problems, if you want it one way or the other, more philosophical. But this is the same formulation of, or similar formulation. The fact that because we don't have this logic organization of the world, what we have here is a sort of flu of things that we can call reality, if you want it one way or the other. And we have the person here, one way or the other, who have a sort of experience, if you want, or perception. So what happened at the beginning of the 20th century is that the people started to discover that there was no connection between the experience, the thought, and the perception, and what we call reality. It was a lack of connection. This is what we call it incommensurability. People was feeling that things were falling apart, and they were remaining more and more isolated. So this lack of connection and communication, according to some people, can be sorted out by the psychoanalysis. The psychoanalysis can give you the link. Not the norm, remember, it's not what the seekers were saying, that you go back to the norm. No, there were norms here. That was a matter of perception. So what Freud was trying to teach, if you want, his patient, was to not be happy, but to feel relaxed and cool as regarding to the way in which the people was perceiving the world. Not change the perception of the world of the people, but teach the people to live with that kind of perception. Well, that is the that's why some critics from Freud, they say that the psychoanalysis at the end is a sort of idealism. Why? Because teach the people to think that they can live with their own ideas as far as they figure out a way to connect with other people, which is not maybe a real communication, but the idea that you construct the world in your own mind, that is the idea of idealism. As I say, the world is here on you and not in the physical system. So in literature you have many possibilities. There were people who were using this technique to write a particular novel, for example. There were people who were using explicitly the theory of psychoanalysis within the novels. You have as well people who were, if you want, more in a more elusive way, they were using the idea of psychoanalysis to explain the cultural context of a particular novel. They were, if you want, novels who came up in a sort of classification, because you see what happened with the Freud theory is that after the Freud theories became popular in one way or the other, you have this kind of division which didn't happen before. This is interesting because it had to do with a commercial thing in the 20th century, and now it's really, really powerful. But you see, Freud was saying basically this is your life, this is your zero time, then you got, he was making all the stages. Say, for example, you have the first period, which is 6 months, then you have the second period, which is 2, then you have the fourth, and then you have the sixth. Everyone was one of the particular characteristics and growing. In every stage, you develop a particular capability. Alright? But basically, he was saying that the most important part of your life probably will be these 6 first years. And then you start to develop others, more or less up to the 17 or 18, in which basically he says, well, you are there. You start to be conscious about your problems, and that is the crisis of the adolescence, if you want. So, why I'm explaining this? Because imagine, when this theory became popular, what happened? Well, it's very, very simple. People are going to chunk here, and you are going to have books 4, 7 to 12, books 4, 13 to 15, and so on and so on and so on. What is the consequence of this? Well, it's the consequence to think that you can make separate part of your life. so that we can, or we are allowed to think that between 10 and 12, to say the name, there is a particular special need, and there is a particular special idea of what you were looking for. With the books, it's very clear. You see the books, if you, the children books, if you turn it down, you see, they say in a small number, say, if it's of the 10, what is the meaning of that? The meaning is this, it's 4. It's the idea that our life is divided, and when we are 7, we do things that we don't when we are 14, which is not necessarily true. But this have a very commercial side, very important commercial side, which is very, very powerful. And that is why it has been, if you want, so popular. And, well, you have the probably the most successful one recently is Harry Potter. Because it's a book whose character represented the audience, you see. And this is coming from Freud. Because what happened here? An example, in the book of the children, even early now, because you have more sophisticated. But is that the plot was specifically designed by this to this audience. So they say you have animals, or you have a particular plot, or you have characters who match the age of your audience. This was important. Why? Because the most innocent approach that you can offer on a particular audience is to present a character who match your age. You see, when even other people will say, oh, that's a book for a young person, like I'm saying to someone you are in the 40s and 50s, like I'm saying, this is a book that you maybe will write in your reading when you are 20 or 25, and not when you are 40. What is the meaning of that? Well, this is the meaning of that. And this is a consequence of the psychoanalysis, which is the idea that you can divide the culture. Why? Because you think the culture is a functional piece that you can use it. So you use it to help people in this, in the, when they have 7, 15, and so on, and so on, and so on. But it's interesting because people who came after Freud, they say that as more functional you embrace the culture, less aesthetical experience you have. And this is interesting. And this is Benjamin. Benjamin, basically, the classic that probably you know, is the art in the mechanical, in the art in the epoch of, how is it, it's complete title, I don't remember. The art in the period of the mechanical reproduction, something like that. Benjamin, who indeed knew very well Freud, was saying exactly this. As more mechanical we reproduce things, objects, and indeed these objects are cultural objects, less aesthetical experience we have. What is the meaning of that? The meaning is that Benjamin was talking about the aura. What is the aura? Well, imagine that this is a saint, sort of. Okay? Yeah. So, in traditional speaking, the aura was this. Was this kind of light who was not clear, who was surrounding the person, was magic. Okay? That is explicit. But aesthetically speaking, this exists as well, but is not present. Let's say, when you go and you see, I don't know, La Gioconda, imagine. There is something there. You see, when the people say, oh, there is something there. That something who is not visible there, that something that you don't have word to define, that something is the aura. So that extra meaning that attracts you, that is what Benjamin was calling aura. And what Benjamin is saying is, as more functionally culture became, less experience of this no meaning we have. And he said, and that is bad. Why is bad? Because we lose one of the most important assets of human beings, which is this idea to face the unknown. Because when you face something that is not visible, but you feel good, and you don't know, you do not know. Why? That is good. Because that is the unknown. It's something that you don't know, but challenges you. If we lost that, we lost a challenge, and we became more and more in a society civilized, if you want, organized, in which we don't have freedom. Because that is the point. Benjamin was talking about freedom. As less art we have in a society, less freedom we have. Maybe because that he commits suicide. Questions? No?
In your run of life,
Here, but in a special case, because the from all of these, Jung was probably the most closest to Freud, more than these ones. And also because Jung was one of the few who go back to archaeology, if you want, and go back to a discussion who was very, very, well, let's say, popular during the 19th century and up to the 30s in Europe about the culture. You know, in Germany, this strong discussion about the culture. The relation, not the culture, the relation between civilization and culture. How far we can go if we study culture as a matter of civilization. And of course, Jan was referring to Spengler. Remember, if you don't know, Spengler wrote this book, which is the declination of the West civilization, or something like that in English, in which he was saying we are in a period in which we are declining as a civilization. That is normal for all sorts of reasons that he gave away. And that book created a sort of school that people was against or for it, but was a sort of discussion who was there. And Freud never acknowledged that until the 70s, I mean, when he was really almost dead. And Jung was pointing out that really early, at the beginning of the 20th century, say, okay, your theory is very good, but this should be contextualized, your theory. It should be put in context with the discussion we have about culture. Freud refused to do that at that stage, but Jung did it. That's the reason why a lot of people who are working in archaeology try to, especially those who are working with ancient civilizations, and religious civilization, use Jung quite a lot, because Jung was trying to using archaeology and a particular idea of culture, tackle the same issue that Freud. I mean, the fact that we have unknown part of our psyche that maybe they need to be unknown. That's the great difference between Jung and Freud, because Jung says maybe that's the way, and that's why he went to ancient civilizations to explore how these people was living with that without any problem, trying to oppose him to Freud, but because Freud presented the psychoanalysis as a necessity. This guy was saying, look, other ancient civilizations were living with this kind of problem for long, and they never feel compelled to change that. But yes, and it's very interesting, eh? There are two or three books really, really, really interesting. And what is, if you want, what there is in a sort of third school, if you want, a third movement, is that all these people working, let's say, in psychoanalysis, again, for this or whatever, have a sort of consequence in philosophy. Not because philosophy have a sort of a school who dedicated themselves to psychoanalysis, but all the concepts who are discussing here were picking up from other people and developed it in another way. The most notorious that time probably is Henri Bergson. Henri Bergson developed a theory. He called it l'élan vital. L'élan vital, l'élan says, is like the aura. It's something that you cannot define. It's something who is on you, but is the element who keeps you alive. So he was trying to explain, philosophically speaking, what are the consequences of this. And interesting, because Bergson connected these, if you want, one way or the other, with modern science. So he connects all these problems of the psyche with the idea of light, with the idea of matter, and of course with the idea of image. And that is why person is so important, and that is why people like Gilles Deleuze and other people, Foucault, even went back to Bergson to describe this idea of time and space in relation with matter, in relation with the modern, or what we can call modern psyche. Even people who was working in issues like a memory, like for example Paul Ricoeur, who can be go back there and speaking the devil, probably these men have used the last big and more profound interpretation of Freud in the 70s. He wrote a book, we call it De la Interpretation, in which he was trying to combine Freud ideas with hermeneutics. Basically, he was concentrating the idea of perception and the idea of reading, and how those ideas were working from the hermeneutic in connection with itself. In my view, that's probably is after the Lacan theory, probably this one, even if it's not that notorious, I think it's very, very interesting one, because he picking up a couple of issues from Freud very cleverly and connecting with the idea of perception, reading, and who were familiar to the the book, anyway, when the moment came up, was criticized badly, because all the people who were following Freud were with Lacan, and this guy was making a more historical approach, so he was looked as a sort of conservative person, but that was a pity. But the book is very so I think that's it, basically. Yeah, I think that's keeping the basic. Then change dramatically and depends where, in which context you apply psychoanalysis, in which area you apply psychoanalysis, and so on. As I say, there were two kind of connection with psychoanalysis. The ones who to produce a particular piece of analysis or a particular piece of art, use the methodology that they call psychoanalysis, like for example the surrealism people, in which they say, for example, the most famous one is the automatic writing. Have you heard this automatic writing? The people say, oh, the only way I can express my unconsciousness is to write without thinking. And they were doing this, called it automatic writing. The surrealism do that. That is an example on how people can use psychoanalysis as a methodology. A little bit more sophisticated is when you introduce psychoanalysis as a subject in your writing, basically. Either because you use it in an analytical sense, or because you use it to create, as I said before, characters or situations. Probably the most successful joint venture, theoretically speaking, of the 20th century, indeed, is when psychoanalysis and Marxism get all together. And if we conduct a survey and our sort of inquiry, probably 80% of the people who was doing critical analysis about literature, culture, or philosophy, they were included in this sort of connection. So, remember what we discussed about Marx? We have the building, so we have the infrastructure, and we have the superstructure. Here is what we are looking for. This is, if you want, we have here culture, artist manifestations, but these are a reproduction of what really is in the infrastructure. Number one. And number two, this need to be seen in a sort of historical perspective, in which periods are from particularly synthesis, going to the antithesis, and going to the synthesis. And they go in that way. And as well in a particular division from which we went to primitive societies, to sort of sub-developed societies, to developed society, and to industrial society, which is the last stage that Marx discussed. Alright? So, on the other hand, we have the unconsciousness and the consciousness. So we have basically, what the people do, some of them following the Jung criticism to Freud, was to associate one to the other. How? Basically, they picking up the unconsciousness, and they say the unconsciousness is similar to the problem of the infrastructure. We cannot see that, that is not evident in everyday life. What we need to do is to create a methodology, theoretically speaking, to understand this infrastructure. Equally, in psychoanalysis, we need to do the same. What is the difference? This is for individual, this is for society. But the approach is exactly the same. That is what these people were saying. More important, this lack of, that I mentioned before regarding to Jung, this lack of contextualization, which some critics accuse Freud, in one way or the other, was covered by the Marxism, or by this particular approach of Marxism. Why? Well, very simple. Because all this historical structure is the one who gives the context to the consciousness. So, what is this interesting is that both help one to the other. Basically, this neo-Freudian Marxist people were saying we have now two possibilities, we are better, because with Freud we only have one possibility, one treatment and consciousness, period. With the Marxism we have one possibility to understand how, sociologically speaking, the society goes. And now, if we join the two, that means that we can explain the individual to explain the society, or we can explain the society and then we got some answers about the individual. Imagine from the analytic point of view, this is a piece of cake. You can solve all your problems. Because an example, picking up a novel, you go to the novel, you want to analyze the novel, you read the novel and you say, there are not much characteristics about a character here. Basically, this is a novel of situation in which there are long descriptions, in which the situation are described with a few comments from the characters. So, what approach do you think will be more suitable for you?
Society.
Yes, you fit the society because you have long description. You know nothing about the individual people. So you use that, you describe that, and then you get some kind of psychoanalytical profile. Or you do the opposite. There you have imagine Kafka, Sansa. What do you got? A man who is talking. So you get an individual and you try to figure out what kind of individual. And then Kafka is interesting. Who is the main subject of Sansa? Father. Imagine. So, well, you have the proof. All the people talk about Kafka basically. Even my grandmother was talking about Kafka, I think. basically this is this type let's call it joint venture, call it in that way, but I think it's the most common and successful. And this started to happen, let's say 40s, in the 50s, but in the 60s another element came out who make this system more even solid, let's call it that way, which is linguistics. Because, if you remember, what Lacan was saying is unconsciousness of a linguistic structure. So therefore, what means is that a lot of people were suggesting that the let's say the Marxism perspective regarding to history can be approached in the same way, basically that we need to be aware about linguistic, but not necessarily about linguistic, about number one, what is the meaning of a language conceptually speaking, and number two, how historical speaking the evolution of that language happen. When we have the two, we have a sort of method, if you want. With this methodology, what we do? We try to explain this.
How?
Very simply, historiographical approach. We were back. We want to understand England in the 1930s in Manchester. What we do? We will have a look everything who has been written about that. It doesn't matter what. History book, travel books, whatever. And then we have a picture of society. Who is doing, what's doing that? An example? Thompson. Here in England. Historical man who produced one of the first Marxist approaches, if you want. And this is important because what changed this from the previous approach? The previous approach, history, what was history? Was the history of governments? Or was the history of the monuments? Or history of the great events? Like here, I mean, who was the King X? Who was the King? These people were saying, no, there are no hierarchy here. Everything, doesn't matter. Why? Because what counts is not what. What counts is how. And that is the big difference. And this is what we call it the formal approach. Why? Because the method, the methodology is more important than the content. And this is when another people, we discussed already, came up in another area, like a Levi-Strauss, and create the structuralism. Why? Because he was saying, because the form is more important than the content. But not only that, it's because we need to study civilization. So he moved from, if you want, from this approach into the area of archaeology, if you want, anthropology, if you want to call it that way. And if you want to go further and connect with what we discussed already, will be another people who following this will be saying, oh, wait, but this element, these culture elements in which we formally analyze now are so important that we shouldn't care no anymore about the building, because we have the symbol of the building. Who were that? The semioticians. Why? Because they say we are living in a society who became so sophisticated that the language who indicate the building is more important than the building itself. Why? Because the majority of the people never came across with the building, ever. Why? Because who knows where the building is? We know, we have only symbol of things. We don't have any more of the contact with the things. And they are the semioticians. Like, I don't know, Hollenbach, if you want. And then, of course, at that point, we are, let's say, middle of the 80s, is when really what was one of the biggest discussions of the 20th century disappeared forever, the idea of reality. Because in those all the stages, always this discussion about an art, that was real, was not real, or be against the real, or that was really an issue. But at that point, that disappeared. The meaning of reality was not an important issue anymore in art or literature. And you see that nowadays. When people describe a book, they don't bother that much about what is the meaning of reality. I mean, people who are working in economics or in other areas, because they need a sense of reality, not because they believe in there is any reality. They need a sense of reality. So for that, that is present. But in art, no anymore. There are other issues who are more important now, like a symbol, value, visibility, and so on. Questions? No? You seem shocked. Let's see if there is something that I overlook. And you see, I mean, I say to myself, and always I start this course every year and say, if I manage to explain to you in very simple terms that all these theories are connected, and as soon as you understand two or three principles, you can allocate them. If this is the only thing you get from this course, I'm happy. And I tell you, this is important, because when you are reading a novel, you can adapt what is the feature of the novel to the system. So it's not a matter what theory you like, it's a matter what theory is more pertinent to the book that you are facing, you see. And if you know this connection, it's easy to understand that. It's very, very easy. So if you have any aim regarding to theory, it's not that know who was what or have this encyclopedial knowledge. It's have this kind of a structure in which you can connect one theory to the other. That is crucial. In MA you have a first taste for that, but if you are doing a PhD, this is the command that you should have. Forget what you're doing, you can do physics or whatever, but this kind of awareness of the theory is what is really, really useful, and this is called epistemology, basically. Let me see. True, I forgot that. There is another connection which is very, very important between the Marxism and the Freud, and is the theory of money. Theory of money. Because it's true that Freud himself, especially in the late Freud, was saying that what moved human beings at the end are money. For Marx, the money was more connected to financial issues, but to Freud, was connected to value. When Freud was saying money, he was saying value. I mean, it's natural in the human being to try to possess as much value as possible. In the example of Freud, it's very, very simple, and it's interesting. Freud is talking about the family, and he's talking in this why at some point the son killed the father. This idea that Freud had, that to survive the smallest, the younger within the species need to call the elders. I mean, need to kill the elders. Why? Well, some people say maybe because the food was not enough there, so to survive, one of the strongest killed the others to have more food. But Freud was saying something which is interesting. There is another element, the woman. The men kill another man to possess all the women. No one. He won all of them. And this is interesting because you see, it's not about something that you can possess, like the gold, like the material money. You know, it was a symbolical, because imagine you, even if you are the strongest man, how many women you can possess. I mean, so the idea was have the notion that you can possess the woman, not do it, the possession of the woman, the notion, and that is a symbolic value. So in the roots of this importance, if you want, element, was already the idea that symbolic values are crucial, are fundamental. And that is when Marx and Freud connect, because Freud was giving the idea that values are important, and Marx was saying these values are money and are currency, if you want, one way or the other. That could be explained socially speaking, meaning men want all the women, or can be done materially speaking, men want to be the owner of much land as possible. So that's why, an example, imagine you have a novel, 19th century novel. The hero is a man who is a rich man, who have a family, have a wife, who the same social sector, obviously, who have two or three children. And this man, of course, have two or three lovers. Explanation of the critics, which one will be? Well, normal. Why? Because the man who is the owner of the majority of the land and who control the small town want to have all the women of the town. Why? Because one sense of property, in physically speaking, need to be linked with one symbolic sense of the property. And that will be, of course, done by the critics in talking about bourgeois and talking about how the 19th century society was in a sort of a fixed society without connection one class to the other, and because that allowed these men to take profit on a condition who normally he should not be. You see, that could be in a very quick neo-Marxist psychoanalytical analysis of a 19th century novel. There are Sense and Sensibility, there are a couple of two or three films who were made around here who are that kind of grounded in books, who were that kind of. There is another one, the woman of the lieutenant, French lieutenant, I think it's that's another one. I mean, always these stories in which society were fixed and there was this conflict between people who was having all the things and the other who were not having that much, and a conflict with a woman in the middle, and the woman is a main character and she feels in one way like a sort of object, in another way like a sort of human being. Why? Because in one way he was treated as a sort of symbol or a piece of land, in another way he was treated as a human being. So the two together. So how you can analyze a character, a feminine character in a novel like that, with this. You explain the social situation, who forced this woman to do that, or you can explain the male situation, who forced the woman to do that, and so on. So. So well, then in this chapter you have a, if you want, you have more the anecdotal part of the Freud theory, the idea of the fallow and so on. And but that's easy. You can do that in your own. I mean, all the stages, you know, the baby and the connection between the baby and the eschatological elements and so on. He said in page 139, say, Freud is not in this sense a rationalist, believing that if only we understand ourselves or the world, we can take appropriate action. You see, that's when people say he wasn't an idealist, because he paid attention more to the individual than to any other element. He said his estimate of human capacities in his is on the whole conservative and pessimistic. There is indeed a real problem about how social and historical factors are related to the unconscious. That's a young critic. And of course, because Eagleton is a Marxist, he says at the end of page 141, what Freud produced indeed is nothing less than a materialist theory of the making of the human subject. You see, this is a Marxist approach. Because the people who were really Marxist extreme were seeing Freud as a sort of Marxist who defeat to concentrate here and not here. I explained to you the ones who were trying to join the theory, but of course, as you can imagine, were people who were not trying to join, were against them that joined. And the people who was really, really extreme Marxist, they were saying, what Freud is doing is concentrating on the top of the building. It's losing the perspective here, and this is what Eagleton is saying, basically. That is a sort of sui generis Marxist theory. Yeah, it's okay. The rest, you have it already from the other classes. He describes some kind of... he talked about an example, Althusser, we discussed it already, and that is a scheme from Althusser. So that will be okay. Right. That's it. I'm still thinking about this French, bloody French, pompous. It's no Watson. I get confused with Watson. It's no Watson. No. Anyway, it's going to come to my mind. I'll send you an email. Right. Okay. So, crack up. Okay. We do a sort of analysis, and if you wish, bring your notes, line, title, piece of work, masterpiece, whatever, and we discuss it. If you have any problem, if you wish, you can send it to me before, and then I have time to read up and comment here in class. I mean, that would be the easy one. I mean, believe me, the best thing you can do is, now that you are a little bit hot with this issue, get things done. So the deadline is, forgot that, I got it somewhere.
The 2nd of June.
2nd of June.
Okay.